You're listening to Writers on Writing, a show about the art, craft, and business of writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. My guest today is Jill Simmet, author of The Body in Question. Jill Simmet was born in Montreal, Canada. She's the author of Small Claims, a collection of short stories and novellas, The Law of Falling, Bodies, Teeth of the Dog, The Tattoo Artist, Heroic Measures, Act of God, The Body in Question, and Half a Life and Consent, which are memoirs. She's been the recipient of numerous grants and awards, among them a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship, two New York Foundation for the Arts Fellowships, the Janet Heidinger Kafka Prize, and a Guggenheim Fellowship. Simmet is professor emeritus at the University of Florida. She lives in Gainesville, Florida, and New York City. On the show, we talk about so many aspects of writing, but we focus on her book, The Body in Question, spoilers and all. A couple of months ago, I let our Patreon supporters know about this. So if you hate spoilers, consider reading the book first. It's a thin novel, and then listen to the show. I recently spent 2 weeks in jury duty on a criminal case, and during the first week, I reread this book because criminal case here is the B story. The A story is an affair the narrator has with a fellow juror, known only by his number until about three quarters of the way through the book when the case is over. Jill was on the show with this book when it came out around 2020, and I loved it then, and I loved it now, and I wanted to talk about the ending and other possible spoilers, which is why we're doing this special show. Here's my talk with Jill Simmet, author of The Body in Question. Jill, I'm so glad to talk to you again about The Body in Question. We talked about this book in 2020, perhaps. It was a while ago when it first came out, I think. And since then, we've talked about your memoir, Consent. And I wanted to talk about this again, which we'll get into in a moment. But for those listeners who are not familiar with you or your work, will you talk a little bit about your path to writing?
Well, my path to writing goes back. It's a complicated path to writing. I wasn't one of these children who were who wrote stories and wanted to be a writer. I wanted to be a painter, a visual artist. And it is a complete miracle I became a writer. I mean, I loved literature and I loved reading, but I was terribly dyslexic. And, in those days, you know, you were graded on your grammar and your spelling. And if you were dyslexic, it was like this embarrassment, no matter how much I read or how much I understood when I was reading. You know, and when I first started to write, I had to learn how to compose. It was very hard for me to handwrite because when you're dyslexic, the letters come out wrong. It's hard to read afterward. So learning to type helped me, but it was a long struggle, but I think it was an interesting struggle because I was never facile with language. And therefore, you know, to master language had a different kind of effect. Mm-hmm. I hope it's helped my writing, but maybe it's hurt it. One never knows.
Well, that's interesting. But did you do anything special to deal with the dyslexia? I mean, what do people do with that? What do you do with that?
If you were a lucky person and you had other areas of your brain that could teach you how to not just overcome it, but to kind of excel with it. I mean, mm-hmm. dyslexia can do amazing things. I mean, whereas other people, you know, they look at a boggle thing and can't find the words, or they do Wordle. A dyslexic just sees that stuff, mm-hmm. you know, and it's everybody's brain is so different that, you know, I think that the kids who have dyslexia who get over it and find ways to cope with it, you know, tend to be very successful in life because they've already had to think differently in order to overcome something. But I'm sure most kids have something they have to overcome and think differently about. So, you know, it's sad because I think that it made me feel like I couldn't be a writer because of it. And I think I would have enjoyed writing if I had known how I could break through that kind of stricture of coming from a poor class, having a bad education, and then being dyslexic.
And so is visual art, I mean, you were a visual artist. Is that easier for dyslexics?
I was one of these kids who were born with an unbelievable power to replicate the world in line. I was able to draw a portrait of somebody at like 3 or 4 years old. That wasn't a stick figure, but an actual portrait. It has nothing really to do with art. It's a kind of flukish talent. It's sort of like a piano prodigy who by 18 isn't any better than a regular student, but they were really good early. So it didn't, you know, but it did steer me towards writing because it was something, steer me towards visual arts because it's something I was naturally good at. But it also kind of ended my love of wanting to do that because it was so easy. So obviously I wanted to tackle something that was different.
Interesting. Okay. Well, okay. So let's talk about the body in question. And I will say that one of the reasons I became reinterested in the book, and I loved it back when I read it, when it came out and you were, and had you on, but because I just did jury duty for 2 weeks.
Oh, so there you go.
I'm like, let's see, do I have any books about jury duty? And of course I thought of this one and it's also under 200 pages. So it was very light to carry, right? You know, whip out at lunch or whenever we had these huge long breaks. And I also told our Patreon supporters that we were going to talk about the books, no spoiler. I mean, we're going to talk about everything. We're going to talk about the ending. So if you're listening and you haven't read the book yet, well, I'm sorry, but you could always listen to the earlier interview that we did that's accessible on the website where we don't talk about the ending. But I love this book, and I'm not exactly sure why. I loved it before I did jury duty. It's just bare, you know. It feels like everything. There's no padding, and one of the things that drives me crazy about novels, big novels, is when I feel like there's just a lot of padding that you don't really need. That for some reason is there. I don't know if it's because writers are encouraged to make sure they have 350 pages, make sure they have a big book. I don't know. What do you have any ideas about that? Because I noticed that most of your books are on the thin side, which I appreciate.
I write novellas. I write a novella. That's, and my stuff is situational. It is, you know, very, I wouldn't say taciturn, but I try really hard not to include anything that I wouldn't include if I was sitting across from the reader. I mean, if I was sitting across from the reader, I wouldn't spend 2 pages, which would take 3 minutes of talking, describing a lawn that had no place in the novel. Okay. Sure. You know, so I always think of what I do, and it's not, you know, there's a million different kinds of novels and they serve all kinds of different, you know, functions, and people want a long big book and a short book at different times of their lives.
But for me,
what interests me in writing is, one, never to repeat the same thought so that the thing has a propulsion, so that every sentence tells you something new that you didn't know about either the situation or the character or the plot. And if it isn't about what I'm trying to talk about, I just condense it. I mean, you know, if you want to show how someone lives, there's a million ways in which to do it. And unless where and why and their living situation is important to the story I'm trying to tell. Otherwise, I don't describe the living situation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I also have learned, I mean, it's taken a long time. I mean, if you look at my earlier books, they're not, they're more, the language is much more opaque. And by that, I mean, the reader is much more going to be alert to the idea that this book has been written and thought about in that way.
Mm-hmm.
The language will suddenly become opaque. And, you know, as I get older, I'm much more interested in very transparent language in the sense that my language should only be about precisely telling the story I want to tell, not anything extraneous. And that's mm-hmm. what interests me. It's not the only way to write, but it's my way of doing it.
Yeah. No, I love big books too. But what really makes me crazy about sometimes with bigger books is I feel like 100 pages could have been cut, or 20,000 words, or just it to, sometimes they feel a little padded, and that just drives me crazy.
It drives me crazy, but you know, I think that being driven crazy by padding is also a element of aging. I mean, I think that when you know, you first are embracing literature, you know, you want to drink in as much as you can. And these long divergent passages that people mm-hmm. put in are really exciting, you know, mm-hmm. to discover that they can, that a person can, I don't want to use Trump's word weave, but, you know, can go back and forth and do those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And I was really interested in that too for a long time. But again, unless the digression is going to tell me something really important about the story I'm interested in, I don't have the patience for it any longer. I don't have the patience to write it. I don't have the patience mm-hmm. to read it.
How many words do you think the body in question is?
I have never done a word count. I know in manuscript it was like 190. And I have a lot of like white around it because I take notes all the time.
Yeah.
So
yeah, interesting.
But I never look at word counts. I didn't.
You don't.
I just don't.
So I am curious, well, what you just said, because you deal with detail sparingly, you know, like I think you describe, there's two main characters. The narrator is C2, because for those
Yes,
of you
jury.
Who have never done jury duty, you get a number. So you don't learn each other's names unless you make it a point. Names at some point. But she is C2 and he is F17, I think.
Yes.
Yeah. F17. And you describe him briefly, so briefly. I just remember his skin. I think he has bad skin, perhaps.
He had acne as a child.
As a child.
And you know, it's something that forms your character, I think. Mm-hmm. That was why I chose that.
But he's kind of alluring, right? There's something else you say about him, that he just seems like this really alluring, compelling dude that she, you know, somehow connects with during this jury.
I mean, it's also from her point of view. So, I mean, right. She's attract, you know, so, you know, him being alluring is because it's through her eyes. I mean, would he be alluring if we just saw him walking down the street? I don't know. But he's alluring, you know, and part of, I think, the thing that makes her interested in him, going back to the skin, is that, you know, sometimes when you see someone who have really kind eyes mm-hmm. and their skin has been in some way changed from being like this porcelain to this lived in skin, it can be very attractive.
Right.
So right. That was what I was trying to get at.
Have you done jury duty?
Oh, yes, I have.
Well, I was curious just, you know, how much you lifted from your life for this book.
I lifted from my life having an old husband who dies. Okay. I have been on jury duties. My youngest brother was a public defender in Manhattan, so I sat through a bunch of moot courts, which are these kind of dramatized jury duties that you help lawyers figure it out. It's just one of the most interesting experiences a human being can have. And I sat on two real cases, and it's not important the depth of the case. It's just you really get a sense. And I always wanted to do something with that experience. But it wasn't until I was thinking about it somehow intersected with the idea of a love affair that was so distracting that you wouldn't be able to pay attention. Because I watched, people don't pay attention during jury duty and they do fall asleep. And everything that, I read all these jury accounts, from the O.J. Simpson jurors to the Trayvon, what's I've forgotten his name, the George, what was his name, the guy
George
who,
Floyd. No.
not George Floyd. George Floyd didn't get to have a trial because they
No.
murdered him. No, this is the guy who just shot this poor kid because he was wearing a hoodie in
Right, right,
Florida.
right.
I've forgotten his name. Anyhow, so I read all their accounts, and it's pretty interesting to read jurors' accounts. Particularly when they're in these really, they're like it's a celebrity trial. And Florida seemed like such a good. I was my this is my first Florida book, and I've been living here for 20 years, so I was excited to be able to write something about the heart of Florida, and I thought a case like this would do it.
Did you have an affair?
No, I and the fair. I mean that's whether I had an affair or not. That's another thing. But the affair was, it was more of a moral question as I had a husband who was much, much older than I am. And as he was dying, I was very curious about whether I would go on to have another love affair in my life. Because I was at that point, I was in my early 60s. And so this was my way of sort of testing, which I often will do in my writing. There's something that I'm really curious about, and I'll try to dramatize it and see how it sits. So I think this is more of my way of seeing if I could experience love again, which seems so bizarre that I wouldn't. So I really wanted to put that in. So even though the ending that people find enigmatic, once we're breaking all rules and convention
That's
endings,
right.
I wanted to really ask myself after my husband died, after everything, would I have gone back to this man? And, I mean, I think it's clear that she does, but, I wanted to leave it at a point where it was still a little bit ambiguous because God knows in a week's time she could change her mind, okay? So, but the idea is that she wants to have a union with another human being before she dies.
Yeah, no, I love the ending because just that last paragraph, she takes the cigarette Graham offers, slants it between her lips, leans into the flame. Tip of her cigarette is unsteady, and she has to guide his hand to light it. His hand is the first living thing she has touched in months. She doesn't want to let go. What a great last paragraph.
Thank
Endings
you.
are so hard.
They're hard, and I've had many experiences with endings, okay? And there's a part of me that likes an ending that isn't a wrap up. Although I know people, and I have enjoyed wrap up endings, really endings where you kind of know exactly what will happen if this book were to go on. My favorite ending of any book in the world is the ending of The Sentimental Education by Flaubert. And it's a story, it's not a story of education, it's sort of a story of getting stupider. He was very ironic. And at the very end of the book, after all these adventures, revolutions, people losing lives, everything, the two main characters, who are sort of losers, sit down and they remember an episode where they went to a prostitute when they were little boys, and one of them had his hair curled. And when the prostitute, opened the door for them, they ran away and dropped their flowers. And they turn to each other and they say, that was the best time we ever had. And the irony of that, okay, to me was so beautiful. So it's a hard kind of to have an ending that is unexpected, but satisfying is what you're trying for. But what different people find satisfying very differently.
And also the endings of short stories and the endings of novels can, I mean, people seem to expect more of a closed ended, ending with novels than they do with short stories, right?
I think that's probably true, but again, I don't really write novels. I mean, these would be considered novellas. I mean, they're under 200 pages, so I've never written a book more. So, I think I try for the same kind of ending a short story does.
I this ending though, they get together. Of course they do.
A lot of people don't believe that, okay? A lot of people, read that ending and feel like the book just dropped off. It's a response that you get when you give an ambiguous ending. It's just the way, it's just one of the things that always bothers me about writing workshops is that it's sort of like designing something by committee. And the truth of the matter is, you finally, it's a really hard thing to realize and accept as a writer. But some people like your work and some people don't. And some people think an ending is stupid and some people don't. So you can never, there's no right answer. That's the mystery of sending something into the world.
But with this one, it she takes a cigarette, she's lighting it, she doesn't want to let go. I mean, and with their history.
I thought it was clear, but I'm trying to just, I'm telling you, some people don't find it clear.
It's totally clear. Of course they have to get. Have you, is this the last novel? I know you've written a memoir since. Is this the last novel you wrote?
Yes, this is, well, I'm writing
Published?
one now, but this is the last novel I published.
Do you feel a need to revisit these characters? Do you ever like to go back to characters from a book and see what's next?
No, because I mean, I'm, how do I put this? I'm sort of following, I mean, I'm figuring what I'm writing now is my last book just because of my age, okay? They take, 5 years to write. I'm 72. Probably it'll be my last one. And when, each book for me is a chance to explore something very personal that I want to use to think about certain issues. And so, I'm less interested in following the course of their lives than I am the course of my life. Yes, I could probably take all my novels and string them together to be one continuous story, but it's not what interests me.
Well, it's funny just in terms of age because later on today I'm going to talk with Richard Bausch, who I think just turned 80, and he just came out with another book, and he had one out 2 years ago and 2 years, so 72 now. I think you see.
I'm just, and then, you have to say, well, it's, I'm 72, but the world is also dissolving under my feet.
Well,
So,
that's there's that
there
there's
is that. That's a big thing.
yeah there's that I agree. Who knows with that? So then the beginning of this book, you jump right into it, right? They're taking a break, a cigarette break, and you begin and end with the smoke, which is interesting, right? That circular, that must have been purposeful, right? To begin with them smoking together and to end with them
What
smoking
happens
together.
is you have to figure out, you come up with an idea, two people have an affair and a jury, and they're always together because they're secret. How are they going to get to meet each other outside of this closed group of people for them to have their affair? So you have to invent something. So they would have cigarettes. And then once you've got the cigarette thing going, you know, you just follow it through to its logical conclusion. And that's, you know, how I think, I mean, that's how you make a novel, so to speak. You know, you give them obstacles, but you have to give them, you know, logical ways that they overcome the obstacles. Like I used to, when students used to write, they would, I remember there was, they would jump all the necessary steps. They thought that would make it easier. You know, like they jump, like I remember one of my students wrote about, he took his kids to the beach and he woke up and the children were gone. So he went to a bar and got drunk, you know? And I said, I asked people in the class, how many would get drunk if your children were missing at the beach? No one raised their hand. Okay. So, you know, you either have to develop a character that would be so outside of the norm, or you have to take the reader through these steps that are, seem so boring to the writer that you think, oh, they're just miserable to have to do. And you have to find a way to make them really interesting. Because if you leave them out, no one believes your story. And if you do them as boring as life does them, no one will read your story. So your onus is to find a way to make the most mundane things, like trying to get out of jury duty, into something that has punch and intrigue.
So was this always the beginning? Did you have the beginning right from the start, or do you play around with beginnings and see what sticks, or do you remember how this went, how this one went?
Well, I mean, yeah, it's probably the same way I write, begin every book, which is, you know, I usually know, it's not the details of the story, but normally I know before I start writing exactly where my novel's going. I know what it's about. I don't start until I have all of that. And so what I spend a lot of time doing at the beginning is trying to figure out, where does the story actually begin? Not an hour before it begins, not 10 minutes after it begins, but exactly where it begins. And so that is how I don't enter a novel until I have that. Like the one I'm writing now, I started it before I wrote Consent, which is, you know, maybe 5 years ago. And I couldn't figure out how to start it. And so it took me, you know, all this time, and I just recently figured it out.
Before we bring Jill back on, a few words about Patreon. If you feel inclined to support the show, and we hope you do, Patreon is the way. We offer perks, book giveaways, writing tips and prompts, the opportunity to ask questions of our guest authors, and more. Our Patreon page is at patreon.com/writersonwriting. Another great way to support the show and indie bookstores is by buying books at bookshop.org. Our affiliate stores at bookshop.org/shop/writersonwriting. There you will find The Body in Question, as well as books by other authors who've been on the show and books we recommend. Let's return to Jill Simmons. During that time that you're figuring it out, what are you doing?
God, what am I doing? what am I doing? You know, usually I'm trying to find a novel. Maybe I'm writing something else, but just suddenly something like clicks and I can see the whole thing. It's like, I just know it. And then I can, as I start to write, I can drop things that are like almost prophecies into the work, so that the reader wants to know if they're going to become true. And so that's, you know, but until I know where the novel's going, I don't know where to lead them. You know, I need to know. I mean, it's kind of like a miracle. It's only happened, I've only written 10 novels, so it's only happened 10 times. It's like having a revelation, you know. If you had them every day, they wouldn't be revelations. So, you know, I don't really start until I have that.
So are you writing things down? Are you plotting? Are you keeping notes? Or do you have a notebook? Are you journaling? I mean, like, what are you doing with the idea of the book as it's forming? Are you just keeping it all in your head and figure if it's important, you'll remember? I mean, what are you doing?
I would say that's for the most part, I don't ever outline more than 10, 15 pages ahead. Usually by the chapter. Basically, it's just that I know where I'm going because mm-hmm. I know the climax. That's the only way I can put it. I know where this everything is leading to. I don't know what's going to happen after the climax. I don't know the denouement. That I don't understand. But so once I know what everything is leading to, I'm trying to drop. You know, it's. A reader will follow the first thing you give them. If you start something and you say, you know, if you start by describing the lawn, as we were talking about before, people are going to think the book is about the lawn. Mm-hmm. And it's not like starting with a description is wrong. If you look at Passage to India by Ian Forster, he begins by an entire description of the plains of India, because mm-hmm. that landscape is going to play a vital part later right. on. So that's telling the reader, look at landscape. That's going to play a vital part. So that's where the story begins. That's what I mean by story begins. Like, if you know, one of my favorite beginnings to any story is the postman always rings twice.
Right.
I'd say that those first three or four pages should teach you exactly how to get a story mm-hmm. up and running.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think I remember just even the first line about him falling off a hay truck at noon
yeah.
or something.
Yeah, right. Coming from Tijuana.
So as you're writing, as you're in a project, do you have certain novels or books that you'll read to keep you in that world? Someone that was on a while back uh-huh. described them as her scripture. I think it was Jennifer Hay. She's like, I always have like two books that I consider my scripture that I'll read and reread while I'm writing a current book. And I've never heard that before.
I would say when I was younger, mm-hmm. when I was trying hard to feed myself possibilities, and I got most of my inspiration from the external world, whether it was another person's book. I was totally into that. I always had someone I read, someone that inspires me. But, you know, I don't know if it was, God, I'm trying to remember who said it. I think it was John Cage. He said, you know, an artist at the beginning of their lives, as they were starting to make art, you know, the room is completely crowded. Their parents are in there. Mm-hmm. Their fellow students are in there. The critics are in there. Other artists are in there. And slowly, as the years pass, one by one, these people leave the room until you're alone with your art. And if you're really lucky, you walk out of the room too. Mm. And, you know, I'm sort of, you know, I find myself reading less for inspiration. I'm reading, but it's not, you know, sometimes I don't read fiction for years when I'm writing fiction because I don't want somebody else's voice in my head. Mm-hmm. I find it very confusing. Mm. So, you know, but that wasn't true when I was younger. When I was younger, I had these books that were so, I mean, I remember them. I would kind of burn through all of them, mm-hmm. but that's a different stage of life.
Mm-hmm. Mm. What have you read lately that you've loved?
I'm reading a book right now that it's called, I think it's called Loving in Mist, or God, it's on my Kindle, but I don't have it. It's really good. It's by this British writer. And then I just finished one of my, I'm trying to think of what I really liked. You know what I just finished that I really, really liked was, hang on 1 second. Can we take a break? My neighbor's dog is free and I'm yeah. scared it's going to get eaten yeah. by an alligator.
Okay, the dog's okay?
The dog is okay. The only reason I worry about a stray is I live on a lake that's filled with alligators and they eat dogs. So I try really, when a neighbor's dog escapes, you don't want to go near the lake.
Do the alligators come up on your property and do you have to deal with them?
Yeah, they come up because they, you know, they bask in the sun to get their energy going. I mean, right now they're not on the lawn. I mean, during alligator mating season, it's quite a show here.
Oh my gosh. Is it dangerous? I mean, other than to dogs or cats or little animals, what about to humans?
There's been about, since 1940, I think there's been like 250 alligator bites, maybe 20 deaths. Usually the people who die are drunk and they fall into a pond, or an elderly woman fell into a pond. And then Disney had that extraordinary thing where a child was taken by an alligator at one of their hotels.
Right. Well, I'm glad the dog is okay.
Yeah,
my gosh.
Thank you.
Okay, so you were saying you read
I was talking about the I never remember the book's name. I can tell you exactly what it's about. 15th century France. A man,
okay.
Yeah, goes on. Yeah. But I can never remember the thing. The wife of Augie something. Doesn't matter.
Okay, no, that's fine. That's fine. So back to the body in question. So there is a murder trial during the book.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would imagine part of you figuring out where you were going was figuring out what the trial was going to be about.
Actually, the trial was the last thing I figured
really?
out. It was not really that important to me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, almost any trial would have satisfied. And I found it a really good transcript of a trial that took place in Massachusetts. So I used that transcript as a sort of outline so that I could move through a trial. And I had a lawyer I was working with who read over everything to make sure that, you know, the little she remembers while she's fantasizing about her lover is correct. So, you know, and it was legally correct.
Now, how do you find transcripts?
Oh my God. The one I'm trying to find now it's a nightmare. It, you know, most of the time, if you need to get a transcript of this trial, you have to find the court reporter who transcribed it.
Mm-hmm.
And then usually you have to pay the court reporter to put it from that language that they use, you know, that's a symbolic, like a stenography,
right.
into an actual transcript. So it's hard to get them, but they're public record. I mean, the trial I was trying to get for the book I'm writing now, the woman retired like after the trial, and now she's too old to do the transcript for me, and no one can read her notes.
Oh,
so it's lost forever. But I can't, you know, I'm sure they're recording them these days. This was an old trial.
Right. So are you writing another jury? So you're writing another jury novel?
No, this is, it's a novel that also has a trial in it, but it has nothing to do with juries.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I'm curious. So you wrote the draft. Do you revise as you go? Did you write the whole draft of this book and then deal with it? Because you said it takes you a few years to write a novel. So what is that process like?
Well, usually I write a first draft, which is very bare bones. You know, it's almost like I'm just following my characters. Yeah, I used to always say it's like Jane Goodall when she first got to the jungle and it was hot and she was following these chimpanzees. She was taking notes, you know, the big gray hit, you know, his little friend over the head with a banana, okay, and ate their baby. Like, why? You know, so she would write down all these notes. And then later when she transcribes the notes, which is what I would feel is my second draft after I've followed my characters through their experience.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Either through one of their consciousnesses or through third person, however I decide to do it. And, you know, usually my endings are like really, the last half of the book is just really skimpy because I'm rushing to see where it goes. And then, you know, I have to go back, and after I've got this pattern of what people do to each other, my second draft is I kind of go back and I ask why. Why did they behave like this? And I try to figure out for the reader and make it as complex as human behavior. And, you know, also I put in a lot of my setting at that point because, you know, I've gotten the plot down, or whatever you want to call the stories down. And then, you know, so I always say that's the moment when Jane Goodall goes back to her shack with all her notes and it transcribes it with air conditioning, maybe she has, maybe a shower, but she's not just sweating and following her characters. And then, you know, the last draft is something that, you know, I take a few months off, I go back. It's as if I'm looking at something I wrote 10, 15 years ago. And I try for my third draft to instill that story with as much wisdom as I have, you know, with a kind of looking back at a kind of, you know, when you try and evoke memory. And so I think that, so I give it three big, huge drafts, but each draft is, you know, I must write 500 pages for every 100 pages I keep.
Wait, I wrote something down. I don't know, maybe I got it from your book. Let me see. I had to write this down. I'll find the note in a second. It has to do with cutting and how what you okay, here it is. No, it was Hemingway.
It's
Hemingway to Lillian Ross in a New Yorker profile in 1950. He said, the test of a book is how much good stuff. I love that.
Wait, I couldn't hear you. It broke up for 2 seconds.
The test of a book is how much good stuff you can throw away.
Yeah, that's, I mean, that's, it's, you know, you get to this point where people feel like, look, when years ago, okay, in the 1800s, before we had cinematography, before we had the photograph, you know, when you look at someone like Gogol, he, for the very first time, described what a sky looked like. Not a sky is blue, but really to go into the absolute beauty of what description can be. Okay. I don't think people today have that patience. Nor do I think they should have that patience when they are completely bombarded by imagery. So, does the novel, if it's going to exist past, you know, exist within the, you know, the scope of this new technology, you know, do we need to have those kinds of descriptions? Is that what we're interested in anymore? The other thing you can ask yourself is, you know, now that, you know, people just don't have any quiet, okay, they've got their earbuds in, they're listening to, you know, do people have really rich interior lives? They may not anymore, okay. You know, the novel really depended on a rich interior life. The novel was the only time another human being got to spy on another human being's consciousness. I don't think they're that interested. I don't think consciousness is the most interesting thing we're encountering anymore. I mean, consciousness was sort of born with modernity, and modernity's sort of over. So it'll be interesting to see the shape that the narrative takes. It's not
That is
going to stay the same, okay? There's no way it's going to stay the same. Just like, you know, epic poetry, you know, when we got the printing press, it wasn't necessary any longer. So it's going to be really interesting to see what the forms that narrative takes. I don't believe the novel will be the dominant cultural form that it once was.
And plus, thinner novels too, right? I mean, I just see more of them these days. You call this a novella. I think it's a novel personally because it's bigger than the novellas I've read and more in depth. but I have noticed more thin novels like this. And it used to be that there were few, I mean, a long, long time ago, we had 50,000 word novels, right? And then they got bigger, bigger, bigger. And now there's more thinner ones, which pleases me.
Cute. I mean, one of the things, let's face it, if you have a really thin book, remember it's all through, it's through capitalism, okay? It's all about capitalism, okay?
Right.
So
right.
if you turn in a really small book, okay, they can't charge more than X amount of dollars, but if you mm-hmm. turn in a really fat book, it doesn't cost any more really to produce, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But they can charge another X amount. So yeah, they're doing the same publicity. It's, you know, they can charge more. I mean, in Russia, one of the jokes was you were paid in Russia by how many words you put in. I mean, that was how they paid during the Soviet
right.
times. So people wrote like these like big blockbusters.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, I would say it's the same thing here. And also, you know, if you want men, I hate to say this, but you know, male writers to think something's important, it has to be big. You know, the same thing happened in the art world. I mean, the art world, you know,
really?
I mean, people painted paintings that were only big enough for museums. It's it's like a male thing. I remember there was a bathroom in NYU, the art bathroom. And my husband, who was teaching me at the time, said, you know, somebody had drawn like a penis on the wall, and then somebody came in and draw a bigger penis over that penis, and then someone had drawn a bigger penis, and somebody got on a ladder and drawn a bigger penis over that wall. And I went into the ladies' room, which I was in, and I was teaching there as well. And you know, somebody was taking a survey of women who ate their own hair, and people were like confessing. And I thought, wow, wow, does that tell the difference between the sexes? So I think that people wrote big novels because they made, you know, the great American novel. We call them manuscripts, you know, those big fat male
right.
novels, which
right.
again, it doesn't mean that all big fat books are mm-hmm. ridiculous. It's just.
Right. But yeah. But is it necessary? You know, I mean, and probably what we watch, I mean, TV, you know, grabs everybody's interest. It's so easy to just watch something.
It's so easy. But you know, even TV, if you look at the standard, I sold the rights to The Body in Question to British TV. And God knows if they'll ever make the movie, but you know, they sell it as a 6-part. You know, they always have 6 or 8 parts. The mm-hmm. Brits will do 6 and the Americans do 8.
Right.
And they're always like 2 parts too many, so they have to have like a dream sequence for one. You know? So I mean, so I guess every capitalist form. I mean, one of the great things about the internet and Kindle is you don't know how long the book is.
Right. Well, you know percentages.
You know percentages, but who knows what 38% looks like.
Or how fast it goes, right?
That's right.
How fast it's going to go. But I don't know. I mean, sometimes it's also, I think, a matter of discipline to just turn off the TV and go, I'm going to get my head in a book right now. Because you could just keep sitting there watching, but I'll just force myself to just turn it off. And then I'm in a book and I don't want to go back. I don't want to go
back. I know,
back
it's so quiet and it's so nice when you turn off the TV and go into a book.
Yeah. As much as I enjoy certain series or movies, it's like just forcing myself to turn it off and go, you know what? This will be here tomorrow. You can watch this tomorrow. But why don't you read right now? Because that's part of the job, right? Being a writer, you read. It is
part of the job.
You do.
And but it's also part of the job to be immersed in narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that, I mean, I think that we're getting narratives in so many different ways. It's kind of extraordinary. Like, do you listen to books on tape, for example?
Yeah. Are there certain books that you will listen to rather than read for whatever reason?
I never listen to a book. I only read them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I would listen to a book if they could attach it to my heart. And when I fell asleep, it would stop. But I fall asleep in the middle of like listening to the book. They're so talking on, and you're asleep, and then you wake up and you have no idea how to find your way back to that
You can
moment.
set a timer and turn off the phone.
You can, but it's like 15 minutes. I spend so much time going back to try and find where I was that I find it's better that I read.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'll listen when I walk mostly. That's when I'll listen to books. But I tend to prefer to read the book, whether it's
I understand
Kindle
it better.
Or the paper, either one, you know, depending.
I absorb it. Reading makes me absorb information much more deeply than hearing it. I don't think it's true for everybody, but it's true for me.
Yeah, although I'll listen to nonfiction
but that's
in a
different
way than reading, than fiction. Like I'm looking at a book, Murderland. I just had her on the show the other week, and I listened to the whole thing. I listened to the whole thing on my walks, but I didn't want to read it. I didn't want to read the print for some reason. I don't know why. Maybe because it's such a big book. Maybe that's it. I'm like, oh, I can't lie down with this book. It's going to fall on me. It's going to crush me. I can't do it. Anyway, we are getting to the end of our time. I wonder if you have any, I always ask everybody this, any words of wisdom, any tips for the writers who are listening?
I mean, you know, it depends on, again, where that writer's stage of life is. But for young writers, okay, people who don't know how to make the transition between wanting to be a writer and actually finishing a book, you know, for me, the only way I know how to do it is to do it every day. To make it into, I wake up every morning and I sit down for 2-3 hours. I mean, every morning. I don't take the weekends off. There's enough time after I'm done, since I wake up at 6, to be done at 9. I have enough of the day that I don't have to take off a day. And that routine allows me to be really free to experiment and not worry about wasting time, because I know I'm going to return to it every day. And sometimes I write in the afternoon as well.
What about for the writers who, and I imagine you've had a publisher since you started writing, but what about for writers who've been writing, maybe published a book or so, or are I don't know, dealing with the nightmare of publishing? Maybe they've lost their agent. Maybe they are considering self-publishing. I don't know. What about those writers?
You know, again, the writing world, the publishing world is so different than it used to be. And, you know, I know so many writers in that position. And, you know, I won't be surprised if I'm in that position one day. I mean, you know, you're only as good as your last book. And you're only as good as the money you've made somebody. I mean, you can get all the great reviews in the world, but if you don't make a publisher enough money to put out your book, you know, you lose them. So it's, you know, it's really difficult. I don't believe that the publishing world is that determinative of what is great and what isn't. Okay. You know, I think there's many places where really experimental books can go. I don't think there's anything wrong with self-publishing. I think that it's, you know, the idea of having a publisher is a new idea. I mean, Melville, you know, self-published. I mean,
interesting.
Henry James self-published. I mean, Edith Wharton bought all the copies of his book because he felt so horrible. So I don't think that, but you know, if you're going to self-publish, you really have to know about marketing.
Right.
So unless you're really entrepreneurial, it's not really the best thing to do. If you're really entrepreneurial, people have done amazing things with self-publishing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I used to believe that the publishing world really was the arbitrator of taste, okay? And I now believe that the publishing world is made up of no one who's more intelligent than any of my students have ever been. You know, and so it's all about taste. And I, you know, it would be a shame for people who feel like they have something important to say to be discouraged. But right. Don't self-publish unless you really take marketing seriously. Otherwise, you're just throwing it into the void.
Yeah, and then you hear of these huge, huge deals. I think Taylor Jenkins Reid just got a $40 million book contract.
I don't even know who that is. Who is that?
Yeah, well, it's a very, she's an okay writer with a big following.
You know, maybe, again, who knows? That's a talent. That's a talent unto itself, too. You kind of have to admire people who have such ambition to have big followings. I mean, maybe that is so fascinating to people that's where they're looking for, you know, their conduit to emotion.
Right. Right. It's crazy. Well, writing is the important thing here. You know,
it is.
Keeping the pen moving, keeping the fingers on the keyboard and trying to keep the marketplace away while you're writing, right?
And after you're writing, you should keep away from it too. There's no pleasure in publishing that I've ever encountered. And I've been successful and not successful, and I've been lauded and, you know, criticized. The real experience is in the actual writing. That's the only reason to do it.
Right. That's a good note to end on.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Jill, for being with me again. Thank you. That was Jill Simmons, author of The Body in Question. Thanks for taking the time to listen, and a huge thanks to our Patreon supporters who helped make this show possible. Check out our archive of shows at writersonwriting.com. You can find my Substack page on Substack at Pen on Fire, where there are Q&As with authors who've been on the show. Thanks to Travis Barrett for his music and sound editing. There's more typewriter music on Spotify under the artist Just My Type. No lyrics, making it perfect to use as background music for writing. Travis also has original music on Spotify under his name, Travis Barrett. If you'd like to get in touch, email writersonwritingpodcast@gmail.com. You can reach Travis at travisbarrettcreative@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening, and remember, stay in the chair.